welcome to this soggy Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are happy that you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up a bit later today on Main Street, historian Dr. Tom Ezern listens to the frontier through the ballads of early settlers in his Plainsfolk essay. Then Harvest Public Media heads into forests and grow rooms to explore the booming world of mushrooms. And Our Living Lands visits a program that's keeping elders warm with sustainably harvested firewood. And Main Street begins today with Breanne Anderson. She's the Director of Community Life at Bethany Retirement Living, and she's been named by the North Dakota Activity Professionals as the North Dakota Activity Professional of the Year. And she was awarded that award in Bismarck at the North Dakota Long-Term Care Association's recent convention. Congratulations, Breanne.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
What an exciting award.
Yeah, I am very humbled, very honored. It was an amazing experience down in Bismarck, just at the convention for North Dakota Long-Term Care. I'm grateful to have the honor, but there's so many deserving people in our team and in our department.
And across the state.
Yes.
Quite frankly, who do a challenging job every day. And we're going to get into more of that in just a minute. But I want to learn more about you. You started as a volunteer?
I did.
Take me back to those days.
I started when I was, 15, 16, but actually back in 2007. My grandma had actually moved in. So personal for me, my grandma moved in. I was a young adult. I was volunteering, helping out with different events, different activities, and I fell in love with providing that joy and being around elders and being able to do both of those things at the same time.
Somewhere at some time, this became a job for you.
Yes.
How did that work?
Yeah. So in school, I was able to help out part-time. So I worked as a community life assistant, evenings, weekends, and just throughout the summers when I was able to help out more often. And then once I graduated from NDSU, started working full-time as a community life coordinator.
What was your degree in?
I got a degree in human development and family science, specialized in gerontology, psychology.
So you had an eye on this career.
Yes. I've loved elders, had passion for it since the start. So
in your experience, Breanne, what are some common misconceptions that people might have about elder care that you come across?
Oftentimes people are really scared to make that next step. To go from being independent or from being at home to being in a place that you rely on other people to provide that care, to provide that quality of life, to provide that normalcy for you. And I think that long-term care facilities are really adapting to the people that are coming in.
What does that mean?
So being able to provide the dietary needs and the dietary interests of people that are coming in and the quality of life of what they want to be doing while they're here. Being able to provide that therapy so that if it's an ability for them, they're able to improve and go home. So the long-term care facility that we have today is vastly different from even 10, 20 years ago. I mean, we have so many additional resources and additional funding and additional volunteers and opportunities to be able to provide truly the best care that they could have and possibly even better care than they would be having at home.
Some people listening might be thinking, yes, but I could never afford that for my loved one. I've got to keep working hard to keep my loved one here, even though it's a challenge. What would you tell that family?
And I'm not 100% comfortable with the details, but I know that there's so many resources through Medicare and Medicaid and other, government funding where you would be able to work with somebody to get your loved one into a care facility. And once here, I mean, there's other opportunities through the community where if it's the best decision for your loved one to stay here, that's great. We have the resources for you, but maybe we have resources for you to return home after being in a transitional care.
What do you do here each and every day?
So I work as the Director of Community Life. I joke a fancy word for activities, events, quality of life. So within my role, I oversee a team at both the Bethany on University and Bethany on 42nd campus. And we provide, you know, those typical events that you would have throughout the day, exercises, word games, trivia, church services, all of those typical day-to-day things. But we're also involved with providing those bigger events, those community-involved activities, working with volunteers, bringing in entertainment, all of those extra icing on the cake types of activities.
My brother's recently retired and he moved to Florida, and I've watched him in the area that he lives in. And what I've started to think about is it must be much easier for someone in a warm climate to do some programming than it might be for you, especially in wintertime, when your options are kind of limited, it seems to me. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I would say we take advantage of the summer, definitely. Once the sun comes out, the snow melts, we are outside. Any event that we can do inside, we're doing outdoors. We do a ton of involvement with going on bus outings and getting out into the community once the snow melts. Mm-hmm. But during the winter, I mean, we try to bring the community to us. It involves more residents, more patients. We're able to bring in school groups, church groups, different entertainment opportunities. We're very fortunate to be in the Fargo-Moorhead area where there's so many people and so many opportunities available.
You mentioned earlier you oversee quite a few people on your staff. Is it hard for you to find staffing?
Like I said, I think that we're in a really good community of people and of potential. I have not seen those challenges. And, you know, working in long-term care and being a representative on the APND board, there are many smaller areas in North Dakota, smaller facilities that are experiencing those challenges. But fortunately, we're holding strong. So
you have talked about your volunteer program. What do volunteers do for you, and how can someone volunteer?
So we're very flexible. We partner with, like I said, many different colleges, many different church programs, organizations, but we also open up that volunteer program to, I mean, anyone, honestly. We have a summer junior volunteer program for individuals that are 10 and up. So incorporating young adults and youth to work with elders and experience that that different culture and that different lifestyle.
So even someone in middle school,
yes,
what could they do?
You know, school's almost out. So we've got many different youth that are coming in, and they help with different varieties of activities. They help us with different tasks, so building those strong, like, leadership skills, coming into the workforce skills. And then throughout the summer, we do throw different parties, pizza parties, socials, have different award systems, and give them, you know, certificates of attendance and certificates of participation, and have different celebrations for them along the way.
Sounds like you provide guidance for these young people.
Yes, definitely. And I, you know, the start of the summer to the end of the summer, you truly do see growth in responsibility and just being there and showing up and having that true interest in serving our elders.
Do you have volunteers that continue to serve year after year after year?
Yeah.
What keeps them coming back?
You know, we have one family in particular that comes to mind who we have had all four of their children over the years, and they you know, have moved off into college, or, you know, off into other positions, other jobs, but still want to come back for those bigger events, still want to come back for the summer programs because they have fun, and we're teaching them to feel the joy that it is to give back. And I think that they feel that.
We're enjoying our conversation with Breanne Anderson. She's the Director of Community Life at Bethany Retirement, and she's been named by the North Dakota Activity Professionals as the North Dakota Activity Professional of the Year. And she was awarded that award in Bismarck at the North Dakota Long-Term Care Association's recent convention. You have to figure out programs, Breanne, that are meaningful and that are more important than just occupying someone's time, I would think.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
You know, people often think long-term care, nursing homes, the stereotypical bingo games. We meet with each of our residents and each of our patients that are here at Bethany. We meet with them one-to-one to find out who they were prior to moving into the facility, who they are now, and what their true interests are. And then combine all of those, work together to find some new ideas. We're very initiating with new ideas, and try to really meet the needs of all of the people that we have here at Bethany. And those needs continue to change as we get new people moving in and have new interests and younger generations coming in.
And also your residents, they continue to age while they're here. Do their needs change then over time?
I think that their interests may not change. Their needs may, so we just adapt the activity or the event to them and their abilities. But I think that, you know, you are who you are and your interests are what make you who you are. And we want to be able to help fulfill those interests while you're with us.
There are different areas where folks can live under the system here at Bethany Retirement Living, from assisted living all the way to memory care. Tell us a little bit about the different stages of those journeys, if you will.
Yeah, so we have a transitional care unit that would be for patients that are coming in short term. So maybe they are recovering from an illness, a surgery, maybe they're just here short term for additional rehabilitation before they go to a lesser level of care.
Maybe back home,
yes,
in that case.
Yep. Uh-huh. And then we have traditional long-term care. So that would be for residents that are moving in here that would need additional support continuing long-term. We also have a memory care unit, our Willow Lane areas. And it's actually one of the largest in the state, which is very cool to be able to have that in our community. And that is specifically for residents that are here long-term and they're living with dementia or Alzheimer's. Otherwise, throughout the rest of the facility here at Bethany, we also have a basic care and an assisted living and a 50-plus apartments. So truly the whole continuum of care.
Do you have enough space?
We do. we're full, but we're very appreciative of who all is here and who all is a part of Bethany.
We were talking earlier, I think that you're known for your creativity. Mm. That's what I'm told. You're a very positive person. Selfless is how you've been described, Bethany. What values or personal practices help you stay grounded and energized in what I must imagine is a very demanding role?
You know, what I tell people that are coming into a role similar to this is that the joy that you are giving comes back 100-fold. Like, to be able to see the reactions of the residents and see how you are building a stronger team within my role as director of the department. It just, I mean, I wear my heart on my sleeve. So it fills me up and I'm just so grateful to be a part of it.
You've worked with the statewide group. You work here to make things better. What sort of things would you like to do either here at a local level or even at a statewide or national level to improve elder care?
Well, I think that oftentimes, like you said, long-term care gets a stigma. And even specifically to the Department of Activities, you know, most often people think of bingo and those stereotypical things. But what I like to work with our team on and work through APND, the national and local organization, is breaking those barriers and truly showing how quality of life doesn't end once you move into long-term care. And that could be, starting as little as incorporating more community into the events that we're hosting at Bethany and getting out into the community and showing maybe on social media how we are truly living at Bethany.
Do you have some rewarding stories without getting into personalities that really have shaped you?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's personal for me. Moving my grandma into a nursing home, she had been with Bethany for over 15 years before she passed, and we were able to spend the side as a family member with with Bethany, and experience those things as a family, experience the holidays in a nursing home, experience, you know, meeting other elders and seeing how health has changed and how people rely on other people, and having that perspective as well as a perspective of being able to provide that quality care, I think is a really cool dynamic, because you're able to see and grow as a leader of what you're providing in activities, but also you're able to feel what the resident, what the family is feeling, because you've been there before.
You've talked a lot about community as we've chatted today, and it takes me back to the COVID time. That must have been really challenging for you. Can you take us back to what it was like for you?
Oof. it was definitely challenging. In my short career, it's been the hardest thing that we've ever experienced. Activities obviously were not necessarily a thing. We weren't able to be in community at all, so we weren't coming out for meals. At one point, we had been shut down to any community coming in. So within our team, our activity team, our community life involvement, we did a ton of one-to-one interaction, and were able to incorporate new technology. So we did a ton of video calls, a lot of Skype, Zoom, FaceTimes. We did, at one point, we were doing in-doorway bingo. So we had live stream systems going on, and we really were able to modernize and advance our department, even though we were going through those struggles. And a story with that, we connected families through video call that maybe wouldn't have done that otherwise, or wouldn't have had those opportunities otherwise. And we're able to see how families connected because of what we were able to provide.
I've told my kids that as I get older, I fully anticipate, and I'm being honest here, AI helping me age more gracefully, perhaps. And you're nodding your head, yes, but yeah. What do you think about that? I think about a little robot who's going to help me out during the day.
Yeah, we're definitely advancing in tech. That was actually one of the conferences we went to down in Bismarck at the North Dakota Long-Term Care Association convention, was how we can incorporate AI and technology into our care. So I gave different, you know, virtual ideas for residents that are living with dementia and having those relaxing experiences, or maybe being able to pull up videos or virtual reality of where somebody grew up and have them have those reminisce experience of, you know, that's the tree that my family built a swing set on, or, you know, have those different memories come back to them. We're working on it. We're definitely advancing in technology, but it's something that I would like to definitely learn more about so we can incorporate that.
What is still out there to be learned about what it means to provide great care to folks who are aging and with you? What do we need to understand better?
I think it's a common misconception that an elder is less of who they were as they age. In my role, and what I've taught my team is that they are 100% who they were, you know, 50 years ago. And they still have those same preferences, those same likes, those same wants. And we want to be able to learn what those are and visit with them and build that rapport with them so that we can provide that for them, or some extent of what they're interested in. And possibly reach out to our community and find those resources so that we can give them that little sense of home while they're at Bethany.
Is it hard for residents that come here to make new friends at their age? And I'm thinking of myself. I kind of like things dialed back now.
Yeah, we have residents and patients that have a preference to, you know, keep to themselves. You know, they maybe have been a farmer their whole life or have driven truck their whole life, and that's who they are. They prefer that solitude and prefer those experiences independently. But we are able to offer that.
And then for those that are interested in coming out, we have all of those opportunities throughout the day, including, you know, communal dining and things like that, that maybe are less structured like an event, but gives them the opportunity to meet other people, being involved in therapy and being involved in a communal setting like Bethany. You have so many experiences throughout your day to meet people, and to meet volunteers and to meet employees and families that are coming in. So I think even if you're not interested in a group event or a group setting, you still have so many opportunities to build relationships.
This is kind of a personal question, but we lost a family member recently who spent a good deal of their time the last couple of years in a facility similar to this, but in another place. And we noticed that that person had challenges with their short-term memory. So almost every dinner was like 51st dates when even though other people knew who our family member was, the family member may not have remembered who they were. And that was a challenge and frustrating. And I guess I'm leading to the question, how do you help folks who are meeting frustrations that they've never had before?
Especially with families that are now have a loved one that has dementia or has Alzheimer's specifically. We have a great support system at Bethany. You know, we have regular care conferences and regular meetings with family members, but we also offer a support group, not only for families that are at Bethany that have loved ones that are living with dementia, but also for the community to be able to come in and come together and kind of share those shared experiences of, hey, this is a first for me and for me as well. So how are we managing it together? What resources are we utilizing? So Endings and Beginnings is the support group that we offer. And we do that a couple of times a year. And we're able to meet with the families that have those questions. And we have, you know, it's an interdisciplinary approach. So we have our therapy team come in. We have our dietitians come in for maybe some of those dietary challenges that are changing with the advancement of the dementia. And then activities, you know, how can we offer those adaptations or those interventions? What ideas maybe does family have that they could bring in, and then we could incorporate those ideas here at Bethany.
So how does someone learn more about that, even if they don't have a loved one here at Bethany?
On our Bethany website, bethanynd.org, or on the Bethany Facebook page. All of those events are advertised, and you can also reach out to our Director of Social Services, who helps to host our Endings and Beginnings group.
There may be some young people who are listening to this and wondering, could this be a career for me? Or some folks in their life that are at a transition point, maybe now asking themselves the same question, something maybe they didn't think about before hearing this. What would you tell a person who might want to make assisting those who are aging live a quality life?
You know, if you're interested in helping out in long-term care or helping out with elders in your community, I think the first and best option would just be to reach out, see what opportunities there are available, see if there are volunteer programs available, check out the online websites and see what even part-time or on-call positions are available just to get your foot in the door. And honestly, I mean, I've been with Bethany for 17 years and I do love it. And I think that getting your foot in the door would definitely be the first place to start.
Some people might be thinking, well, I need to be a CNA, right, to work there. Is that right?
Depends on the role. There are many roles that do not require that CNA certification. Depending on what you'd be interested in helping with or what department you would be looking towards for your interests, there's many roles that do not require specific certifications.
My guest has been Bree Ann Anderson. She is the North Dakota Activity Professional of the Year, as noted by the North Dakota Long-Term Care Association in Bismarck. Summer's coming. We'll see you out and about, Bree Ann.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Best wishes.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
There is a lot still to come on Main Street. Dr. Tom Easern stops by with another one of his great Plainsfolk essays. We'll have a report about mushrooms from Harvest Public Media. another episode of Our Living Lands and This Week in Water. It's all ahead on Main Street. Stay with us. Main Street continues on this Tuesday here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this Plains Folk essay, historian Dr. Tom Ezern tunes into the voices of early settlers, literally, through the ballads they wrote and sang on the homesteading frontier. From comic laments to enduring anthems, these folk songs reveal the grit, humor, and heartbreak of living life on the claim.
Things were pretty raw out on Duck Creek, northeast of Hettinger in Adams County in 1907. But the Milwaukee Railroad had arrived. Soon, over in Lemon, on the South Dakota line, there was a flourishing newspaper, the State Line Herald, by which we know that the boys on Duck Creek, as the editor said, were singing some stanzas about their lives as homesteaders. Don't ask me now my name, an old bachelor I am, and I bet all the same I've an elegant plan. You'll find me out west on the Duck Creek Plain, a starving to death on a government claim. Their stanzas sounded a lot like those penned by George Reichman near Westfield across the river in Emmons County in 1894. His chorus went, Hurrah for Emmons County, the land of the free, the home of the grasshopper, bedbug, and flea. I sing loud its praises, I sing loud its fame, while starving to death on a government claim. Reichman's ballad was published in the Emmons County Record on the 21st of September, 1894. By my paper trail, though, the ballad goes back further, through multiple states, ultimately to Lane County, Kansas, in about 1886, where they sang about the Lane County Bachelor. For there was a symbiotic relationship between the writers of ballads and the editors of newspapers on the homesteading frontier. The newspapers paid their bills by publishing homesteading notices, which were necessary for homesteaders to prove up their claims. Because they needed copy to fill out their columns, the editors published the ballads scrawled out and brought in by their local citizens. Consequently, I have quite a collection of homesteading ballads, hundreds of texts. Recently, at a conference in Sioux Falls devoted to the history of homesteading, I presented a catalog of 8 homesteading ballads, well-documented and worthy of remembrance. A canon, you might call it, in literary terms. I'll share it with you now. Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim, the anthem of the plains, the homesteader's favorite. The Stern Old Bachelor, a comic song about a man alone on a homestead claim. The Kincaider's Song, a ballad from the Nebraska Sandhills, the only one in the canon written by a woman. The Homesteader's Lament, also known as the Lane County Bachelor. The Homesteader's Farewell, a lament by the same guy who wrote Stern Old Bachelor. After the Strip is Open, a song about the land rush in Oklahoma in 1893. Beulah Land, also known as Dakota Land or Kansas Land, and many other local variants. And, of course, Home on the Range, sung throughout the Great Plains, and actually a popular music contest song for high school boys in North Dakota in the 1930s. These are all folk songs, our songs. We hold them in common as people of the plains.
That was our great friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, and another of his wonderful Plains Folk essays. Dr. Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and we are grateful that he shares his Plains Folk essays with our Prairie Public listeners.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Martin Media, bringing Paula Poundstone, comic and regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, to the Fargo Theater on Friday, May 30th. Tickets and information at paulapoundstone.com.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Nationwide, tens of thousands of Indigenous households use firewood to help heat their homes. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel visited one tribe that's making sure their elders have the chopped wood they need.
It's a sun-splashed morning at the Washoe Tribe of Nevada and California's Woodyard, a patch of land about the size of a football field. Foreman Kenneth Cruz, who's backdropped by snow-capped mountains, is watching crew member Jacob Van use a chainsaw to cut up logs of thick tamarack pine.
That looks dense.
Yeah, it is. It's really dense. You could tell the difference between this one and that cedar. This will cut right through that cedar, but when it comes to this tamarack,
These slices of cedar and pine will eventually be hauled over to a firewood processor on the other end of the yard. That machine, making those squeaky sounds, automatically splits logs into even cuts of firewood. They bought this and other equipment with a $1 million grant from the U.S. Forest Service in 2023. Now, the tribe produces about 1,000 cords of firewood a year. One cord provides heating for about 1 month. Some surplus firewood ends up on shelves in local gas stations and grocery stores. If you buy some, you're helping the Washoe Tribe's energy initiative.
The idea is that for every cord that is sold, that also pays to have a cord cut, split, and delivered to a tribal elder.
It's a program called Wood for Elders. It's similar to a food bank, but instead of food, Cruz and his crew deliver firewood to about 110 Washoe elders at no cost. For years, the tribe relied on volunteers to split wood from their forests and donate bundles to as many elders as possible. But they didn't have a consistent amount of volunteers or wood. But now they have a paid crew, and every elder receives at least 3 cords of firewood each winter, which would normally cost someone about $900, Cruz says.
Some rely solely on wood for their heat. You know, that helps out those people that have a hard time through the winter.
The Washoe Tribe says nearly 3/4 of members heat their homes with firewood and have the option of another form of fuel, like propane. But 1/3 heat their homes solely with firewood.
They can't afford to pay, you know, high prices of propane. And if we have long winters with snow, then the firewood is the way that everybody would heat their homes.
That's Washoe Tribal Chairman Sorrell Smokey. He says the tribe strategically removes logs from overgrown forests in areas previously scorched by wildfire. The tribe has also partnered with the National Forest Foundation. The group hauls out damaged logs from forest thinning and donates them to the Washoe Woodyard to use for their elders program. Sam Pankratz is the foundation's Rocky Mountain region manager.
Our ability to remove some of this material and put it to good use while sort of also coming up with solutions to address what to do with hazardous fuels. So it really is a sort of a win-win in that sense.
In all, the foundation provides wood to tribes in Nevada, Idaho, Colorado, New Mexico, Montana, Arizona, and California. They partner with the Hopi, Ute Mountain Ute, Northern Arapaho, Shoshone Paiute, Eastern Shoshone, Shoshone Bannock tribes, and Navajo Nation. In the Navajo Nation, which stretches across parts of Arizona, Utah, New Mexico, more than 60% of households use wood to heat their homes. Thousands of families. Rosanna Jumbo Fitch is the Navajo Chinle chapter president.
It's a huge benefit because it's used for warming the home, cooking, and everyday needs.
Back at the Washoe Woodyard, Cruz is taking inventory of the different types of timber they have on hand.
Most of it is Jeffrey pine. We do have some sugar pine. We have some red fir, white fir, have some oak, and we do have some cedar.
All of it, more wood for the elders.
To me, it's a good feeling that I think we're doing something good for our communities and for our people.
The Washoe Woodyard will sell firewood to other tribes across the region if they are low on this precious and potentially life-saving energy resource. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Caleb Radel.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
A different kind of Powerball.
That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
During the Biden administration, the EPA concluded that there is no safe amount of forever chemicals in drinking water and issued rules for limiting two of them called PFOA and PFOS. The agency also established standards for three other PFAS chemicals.
Nearly half of all Americans have the pollutants in their drinking water. Utilities are required to monitor the chemicals and be transparent with the public about complying with the new regulations.
Last week, the Trump administration announced it will attempt to end some of the limits and relax the compliance timeframes for others.
There are legal problems with undoing the restrictions. First, Trump's EPA would have to show evidence that the chemicals are safe, despite many studies showing that they aren't.
Also, the agency can't extend the deadline for water utilities because the Safe Drinking Water Act allows only 5 years for compliance.
The compounds, which don't break down in the environment for a very long time, have been used for decades in many household products and in firefighting foams.
Low levels of PFAS are linked to many health issues, including cancers and harm to the nervous system and reproductive organs.
Imagine a large hollow concrete sphere about 30 feet in diameter, weighing 400 tons, that sits on the seabed floor, storing electricity.
The spheres are part of a system called Stored Energy in the Sea, developed by the German Fraunhofer Institute. It works by opening a valve in the sphere to let seawater rush in, which, given the high pressure on the seafloor, drives a turbine to generate electricity. After the water fills the sphere, it can be pumped out using surplus renewable power from the grid and is ready to use again when needed.
The company plans to drop a prototype of the spheres off Long Beach, California by the end of next year. The Institute has already tested a smaller version in Europe.
The system is similar to pumped hydropower on land, where there are two reservoirs, one higher than the other. Water is released to the lower pool, generating electricity as it falls. It's then pumped back to the upper reservoir when power is not in high demand.
The company says its ocean system has an advantage over pumped hydro because it doesn't take up a lot of land.
Coral reefs are suffering worldwide because of warming oceans and acidification from burning fossil fuels. Since 2009, 14% of them have disappeared, and things are expected to get worse.
New research from Scripps Institution of Oceanography is offering hope by creating a scent that smells like home to baby corals, which will help them find a place to live and thrive.
Many corals reproduce through a phenomenon called broadcast spawning, where over days or weeks, male and female reproductive cells merge to form larvae.
Those larvae then float with the currents before eventually finding a hard surface to latch onto. Guiding them to a suitable spot are chemical signals in the water released by algae.
If the larvae don't get a whiff of the right scent, they'll just keep on drifting. The problem is that degraded reefs can't release enough of the attractive smells, and they can also have algae with scents that turn off baby corals.
To solve this problem, the Scripps team developed a gel that releases some of a coral larvae's favorite scents. Called SnapX, it was made from algae collected at a healthy reef, and in lab experiments, it increased larvae settlement by up to 20 times.
They plan to test the gel on an artificial reef during a spawning event this summer to see if larvae find it alluring.
And finally, ever wonder why, after a long swim in a pool, your fingers are all wrinkly and prune-like? Well, researchers at Binghamton University wondered too, and they investigated whether, as it had been believed, it had to do with swelling under the skin.
It didn't. Instead, in their study done in 2023, they found that wrinkles were caused by blood vessels contracting beneath the skin.
But that wasn't the end of the story. When they wrote about their research on the news site The Conversation, a curious kid asked, "Do the wrinkles create the same pattern every time?"
That stumped the Binghamton team, so they investigated more, and in a paper out last week, they say that, why, yes, they do form the same pattern.
That's because when water seeps into sweat ducts in our skin, it decreases the concentration of salt in the outer layer. Nerve fibers sense the change and trigger blood vessels to shrink, dragging our skin down with them. The authors say the reason the pattern stays the same is because blood vessels don't change their position much on our hands.
During their research, the team also made an interesting discovery. They learned that people who have median nerve damage don't develop wrinkles on their fingers.
For the rest of us, the wrinkled response serves a purpose. It creates a more textured surface to grip objects, or in the case of our feet, a way to walk safely on slippery ground.
While the study was conducted to answer a child's simple question, the findings could have important implications for forensics, particularly in identifying fingerprints at crime scenes or bodies found underwater.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Main Street continues on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we head into the woods to explore the booming world of mushrooms. While farms across the Midwest are cultivating special varieties of mushrooms, the elusive morel still holds its wild, mysterious charm for foragers and scientists alike, as we hear in this report from Harvest Public Media.
Inside the grow room at Mushrooms Naturally in O'Fallon, Missouri, it's always spring, or at least something like spring.
So lots of light, fresh air, and humidity, which basically recreates their ideal time of year for all of the varieties that we grow.
Owner J.T. Gelino shows off shelves with logs covered in mushrooms that will soon be for sale.
So we have maitake, or our hen of the woods mushrooms. And then we have our king oyster mushrooms. We've got some shiitake mushrooms.
But one of the most iconic and lucrative Midwestern mushrooms can't be found in this room, the morel. Instead, Gelino heads into a wooded area behind his farm, crossing a small creek and ducking under honeysuckle. Morels are a stemmed mushroom with a pitted, pointed cap. There are a lot of lookalikes out here. Walnut shells and limestone rocks, even leaves.
All of these things initially have that kind of honeycomb appearance that, if they're the right color, will really catch your eye.
Eventually, he finds what he's looking for.
Oh, here's one. See? Now look at this. This is the smallest one I've found yet.
A tiny morel mushroom, the size of Gelino's thumbnail. Mushrooms are getting more and more popular, and specialty mushroom farms like Gelino's are a growing trend in the U.S. Connor Youngerman is an extension support specialist at the Cornell Small Farms Program.
Overall, mushroom production is increasing. Mushroom farmers, there are more and more of them.
But North America's wild morels have a life cycle that has proven tricky to replicate in a farm setting.
Morels are a mysterious and romantic and strange mushroom.
Still, some are trying. Wisconsin-based Field and Forest Products sells mushroom spawn and supplies to farmers and home growers. Lindsay Bender is Field and Forest's chief mycologist and research director. For about the past 5 years, the company has been selling morel spawn. But Bender says they can't guarantee customers will be successful.
We still call it a bag of hope in that we can guarantee that it's good spawn that you're receiving, but you know, the mystery of actually getting that to produce and successfully produce is still the challenge.
In China, farmers are successfully growing large amounts of black morels. And a Michigan state-led study found farmers could reliably grow morels in 5 Midwestern states. But the problem was profit. They didn't grow enough to make money. Field and Forest's Bender thinks in the next few years, the Midwest will catch up.
So there are certainly some limitations to maybe the sustainability of the industry. But I think in terms of developing a more dependable method and culture, I think we're pretty close to that.
Even if Midwesterners could reliably farm the mushroom, many foragers would still head out to the woods. Nebraskan Tersh Kepler has been hunting morels for almost 60 years. He doesn't want to see the mushroom grown commercially.
I honestly don't think they're ever going to figure that one out, at least in, hopefully not in my lifetime. It's an adult Easter egg hunt is what it's like. I don't want that to ever change.
For Kepler and many other Midwesterners, this is a tradition that commercial cultivation won't end. I'm Kate Grimke, Harvest Public Media.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 20th. The first decade of the 20th century was known as the Edwardian Age, named after King Edward VII of Great Britain. Fashion was a distinctive and important element of the era. Women wore corsets and long skirts. Men wore suits. Edwardian fashion was known for its excess, elegance, and above all, strict social rules. Men were expected to wear hats, regardless of the season. In any photograph from the early 1900s, you'd be hard-pressed to find a hatless head. Upper-class men typically wore a three-piece suit, jacket, trousers, and vest, topped off with a tie and a derby or bowler hat. Those who could afford it wore different suits and accessories for morning, afternoon, and evening. With each new season came a change in fashion. Spring brought out a more casual look with linen suits, but hats were still required. Strict fashion rules applied to headwear. Men were expected to remove their hats when they went indoors, while women kept theirs on any time they were in public, indoors or out. In winter, men wore formal, heavy hats like the derby or bowler. These were replaced in spring by straw hats like the boater or Panama. That seasonal shift in hats was so strict that anyone who broke the norm could make headlines. On this date in 1907, one bold North Dakota man decided he'd had enough of winter. He stepped out in public wearing his Panama hat. The Fargo Forum took note, reporting that one man defied the climatic conditions and donned a summer bonnet. It was the first Panama hat spotted in Fargo that season. Though the calendar said late spring, the weather still felt more like early spring or even late fall. But the man seems to thoroughly enjoy wearing it, the paper said, despite the lingering chill. The article ended on a hopeful note, predicting that warmer weather would soon arrive, and with it, many more Panama hats on the streets of Fargo. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Tap a screen, turn a dial, push a button. However you listen, set this station as your go-to. Then catch Morning Edition from NPR News right here every weekday.
From 4 to 9 a.m. Central on Prairie Public. All right, time to play along. Here are some clues to the identity of our guest at our first ever live in-session event.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
You talking to me?
He's an importer-exporter, okay?
Get it? He is Rob, I assume that's short for Robert Port, the much-read opinion columnist and podcaster. And he'll be with us Thursday, May 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at the new Craft Event Space in downtown Fargo. We'll be talking lots of legislature and other issues on the minds of North Dakotans. And if reading Rapport has ever made you feel seen and heard or seething with disagreement, well, you'll get a chance to ask Rob anything you want. Just bring your North Dakota and Minnesota nice, please.
You have no call to get snippy with me. I'm just doing my job here.
You can reserve your free tickets now at prairiepublic.org.
And that wraps up this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, a new Alzheimer's Association report shows that nearly 80% of Americans want an early diagnosis and are open to riskier treatments if they can slow the disease. What would you think about that? Well, we'll ask Joan Danks from the Alzheimer's Association of Minnesota and North Dakota what her advice is on whether it's a good idea to get an early diagnosis to Alzheimer's. That's ahead tomorrow, right here on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.